Thank you very much to everyone for coming. My name is Chad Pecron. I'm one of the co-chairs of the Little Rock Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. Today, along with my friends in the Nebraska Federalist Society Chapter and the Chicago Federalist Society Chapter, I'm very pleased to welcome you to today's event. Normally, I would do rather fulsome introductions of our guests, but because part of the presentation today is for the judges to speak about their own backgrounds, I'll defer on that. I'll just very briefly say that I've known all three of these judges for a long time, and I was very happy to see each of them get on the bench. First is Judge Lee Radofsky from the Eastern District of Arkansas. We also have Judge Brian Bisher from the District of Nebraska, and Judge Stephen Seeger from the Northern District of Illinois. And what we're going to do today is give each of the judges a few minutes to begin just to talk about their path to the bench, their background, their confirmation process, and how they got to where they are. And then we're going to have a discussion about how those different paths have affected them since they've joined the bench over the last few years. And with that, I'll turn it over to Judge Bisher to start.
Okay, thank you very much, Chad, and thank you very much for putting this together. I'm happy to be speaking to the members of the Federalist Society. It's an organization that does great work for our legal profession nationally and has done so for years. And so I'm happy to be participating today. What I'll do is just briefly kind of go back and talk about where I come from, how I got to where I'm at, and just a brief word about my confirmation process, which some of you might know was a bit spirited, as it was for many of us who have come through in the last several years under the Trump administration. As a background, I'm a native Nebraskan. I grew up on a farm over by close to Dewey's, Nebraska, which is a town of 62 people. And after that, I ended up at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, which is where I met Mr. Pecron when he was 17 years old and a freshman in college. And that's how I got to know him. And after 4 years of watching Nebraska actually win football games, unlike the current situation we have, and when I think, what, three national championships in 4 years back in the day, those days are long gone. I ended up at Georgetown Law School and had an excellent experience there. And after Georgetown, I wanted to come back to Nebraska and practice law. And frankly, as I said in my investiture speech, which is online, people can see it there, my real whole intent was to come back to Nebraska and run for Nebraska Attorney General. That's what I wanted to do. And luckily for me, after I practiced law at QTAC Rock, which is the largest firm here in Nebraska, I practiced for 19 years before taking the bench. But after practicing there for 14 years, I had a chance to run for Attorney General of Nebraska. I was the favorite. It looked like I was going to win. The morning of the election, I thought I was going to win. And I got second in the primary, in the Republican primary. And that's just the way life goes sometimes. So, over those years, I also got involved in the political process quite a bit, Republican politics over those years. I ran for office myself. I, attended some Republican conventions as a legal counsel. So that's kind of my history really was through, the political process. I also did a little bit with the Federal Society here and there. It wasn't as active here in Nebraska at the time. But a lot of my work was really with the party side of things. And after my attorney general loss, I expected to be at QTAC Rock for the long term. That's what I thought I'd probably do. I was the head of litigation section or the agribusiness litigation section for the firm. And I did a lot of agricultural law cases. Is something I was able to specialize in. And it was a great practice of law. And what happened was when President Trump won the election, some folks reached out to me with regard to some judicial vacancies here in Nebraska. I told them no twice, that I would not apply, and they didn't like the answer. And the third time I said yes, I would apply, and here I sit today. So that's a sketch of where I was. I guess what I'd like to do next is I'll give you a real brief sketch of what happened with regard to my confirmation process, which turned out, and I knew that I was going to be the discussion of quite a bit of debate, just given my background. I had run for office in 2014, and they asked me every question that you would think they would ask a political candidate, And I answered them very clearly and distinctly on all the issues that you can imagine that might be interesting to a Judiciary Committee in the front of the U.S. Senate. And those were all on tape, usually several times. So I knew what I was getting into once the senators from Nebraska recommended my name to the president for federal judiciary. In the process that you go through in order to be vetted to be on the federal courts, they go through everything you've ever done. They make you write down every speech you ever gave. And every time you've ever been quoted in a newspaper article or anything, I think my list was maybe 500 or 600 items long, or it was very long. Because I had been interviewed so many times on the radio when I was running for office and just in the work, the public work that I did over the years. So I went through all that. I told the White House exactly what I, the items they should look at if they're, they want to know the things that I think that might come up. And they looked at them all and said, let's go. And so what happened was then at my Judiciary Committee hearing, they brought up a variety of the items we expected to bring up, but one thing that came up that was not expected was really what turned out to be a, I would call it an attack on my membership in the Catholic service organization called the Knights of Columbus. And that was not expected. And when that happened, and it was pretty clearly there was suggestion by some in the U.S. Senate that I should resign or should not qualify because I was a member of that group. That turned into a national news story, and I think 600 national news articles later, it was discussion of all sorts of talk shows and articles, and all the way from the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the whole nine yards, and on cable TV it was discussed as well. So that really informed my experience with regard to my confirmation. I was confirmed on what was a party line vote in July of 2019, after a lot of articles and a lot of being in the press. And, you know, I'll be honest, it was very intimidating not to be able to respond to those, because you really can't really respond to those very easily when you're a judicial nominee. So there's my background, my history, my path to the bench. And I was confirmed, and once confirmed, I've now been on the bench since August of 2019. And it's the work is as interesting as I thought it might be. In fact, it's more interesting. So I'll just leave it at that. That's where I've been, where I come from, and how I got to sit in this chair today. I'll turn it over to Mr. Peckerman.
Right. And I'll, before I turn it over to Judge Radofsky to go next, if anyone has questions that they'd like me to ask the panelists later, there's a Q&A button at the bottom of your Zoom screen. You can type the questions into that. With that, I'll turn it over to Judge Radofsky.
Thanks. Let me echo Judge Bush's comments on two points. First, thanks very much to Chad. Chad is a good friend to all three of us, as he said, but he probably undersells it. Before all of us got on the bench, I know he was a close confidant and advisor to each of us, certainly to me, and I appreciate it very much, and I'm sure Judge Seeger and Judge Boucher do as well. The second thing Judge Boucher said that I'd like to associate myself with is thanking the Federalist Society for having us and for letting us come and speak today, and for you all for joining and joining our talk today and for being interested in this stuff and other things the Federalist Society does. I've been a member of the society since the very beginning of law school, and the intellectual and academic diversity and rigor that the society helps to sustain is really important, both on law school campuses and in the wider legal world. With that, let me just run you through my background. I didn't have as exciting of a Senate judiciary hearing as Judge Boucher did. The dogma doesn't live as loudly in me, I guess. It was controversial, but quietly controversial. But anyway, in terms of my background, I grew up on Long Island in New York. My dad was an AUSA, but then by the time I was born, he had moved over to be a partner of a small four-person law firm in New York City. My mom was his billing assistant, and I was essentially the unlawful child labor. All that's to say, I grew up really, you know, working summers and things like that with my dad, and at least learning whatever he'd let me get in on. I went to undergrad at Cornell. I studied industrial and labor relations. I think what was most informative to me, or I guess what was most impressionable to me, was I spent a year abroad, I guess all told a year abroad in Israel, mostly at Haifa University, learning about the Middle East peace process, but in some ways all over Israel during that year. I then got a master's of public administration at Cornell. I had stayed at Cornell and got my JD at Harvard. My most formative experiences there, I would say, were actually my summer clerkships. I clerked in the office of governor of the state of Massachusetts, and that was Mitt Romney, and I'll come back to that in a second. I was also a clerk in the White House counsel's office and as well at Kirkland & Ellis. I then had two clerkships after law school. I clerked on the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, and then I clerked on the Ninth Circuit for Judge Andy Kleinfeld. Both of those experiences are really important for me now, even though they were not experiences that sort of track what I'm doing. They help clearly inform what I'm doing, because I know what people who generally sit above me are going to be looking for when I do what I'm doing now. I went to Kirkland & Ellis after those clerkships. I would say two things stand out about my time at Kirkland. The first was, I don't know how they do it today, but Kirkland stood out back then for not forcing you to sort of work with one or two or three partners or in one department, and you could pick and choose based on each assignment who you would work with. And for me, that gave me a really wide variety into various different legal areas. I was doing things like bankruptcy, white collar crime, appellate litigation, environmental work, comment drafting and rulemakings, all sort of things that ran the gamut. And I guess you could say, both at Kirkland and afterwards, I feel like I've gotten a good generalist education in the law. And I think that's probably affected how I act on the bench, at least I think, sort of mile wide, inch deep kind of things. The other great thing at Kirkland, which I know is true of a lot of DC firms, but maybe not elsewhere, is it had a significant revolving door. And Kirkland essentially let me leave and come back three times, which was very kind of them. And so I got experience on one of those departures working for a small law firm in Alaska while my wife was doing a judicial clerkship. I got on one of the other stints and experience doing work as a deputy general counsel, first on a gubernatorial campaign, and then for the Romney campaign in 2012. And after that, when I went back to work at Kirkland, I really ended up getting a break because I ended up working on the BP trial. And I don't, the Deepwater Horizon trial, if you all remember it. And I don't mean it a break in the sense of like topic area. But why that was such a break for me was there were so many parties involved and there were so many people involved that you couldn't restrict the really important work to the sort of higher level partners. It had to devolve to everybody. And I really sort of earned, I guess, my chops and learned my litigation skill mostly doing that work. After Kirkland, I came to Arkansas and went to work for Walmart. I had two different jobs at Walmart. One was as a lawyer to the press shop and to the government relations shop. And then one was on the business side as a senior director in global anti-corruption compliance. And I think those sort of rounded out my legal experience, letting me do a little bit more of the corporate work, the corporate advising, things like contract negotiation or at least contract writing. And again, that just sort of helped broaden my skill set. And then the one other job I had was I was the Solicitor General of Arkansas, and that really helped me sort of learn how to do high stakes litigation and time pressured litigation, and also a significant amount of appellate criminal work, which was good because I really didn't have any criminal experience. And I think you'll probably hear from everybody on the panel that criminal experience is one thing, at least for me, I wished I had more of when I came to the bench, but at least I had a little bit through the Solicitor General role in Arkansas. That's really sort of my history in terms of what I brought to the bench. And again, I think the key takeaway for me is that I feel like I got a good generalist education in the law.
Thank you, Judge Radofsky. We'll turn it over to Judge Seeger.
Hi, everyone. I'm Steve Seeger. Thank you so much for joining us. And let me say thank you to the Federalist Society and Chad Pecron for putting on this program. I associate myself with the comments that Judge Radofsky and Judge Bisher made. The Federalist Society deserves a ton of credit for promoting thoughtful dialogue. So thank you so much for being here. I'd also say, just as a general matter, I hope everyone is hanging in there with the pandemic. I know this the difficult time for a lot of people, and a lot of people are struggling. I hope everyone participating is hanging in there and keeping their families safe and healthy. Hopefully, relief is on the horizon soon. I grew up in downstate Illinois, in Bloomington Normal. I did not have any connection to the law. Nobody in my family had ever been a lawyer. My parents ran a donut shop. So I grew up with dough in a literal sense, but not a figurative sense. When I went to Wheaton College, and as a freshman just studying about Supreme Court and government, I started becoming interested in maybe learning a little something about the law. And I volunteered at a prosecutor's office that piqued my interest as well. Wound up at Michigan Law School. After law school, I clerked for David Sentell on the DC Circuit. After clerking for Judge Sentell, I returned to Chicago and practiced at Kirkland and Ellis. And, you know, when Judge Radofsky was describing his experience at Kirkland, I felt like I should just cut and paste that and plop it into my presentation, because everything he said could equally apply to mine. It was really a broad-based, generalist, little bit of this, little bit of that practice. And I think it prepared me for the bench in ways that I could not have appreciated at the time. I think one of the many challenges of being a district court judge is you're exposed to so many things in so many areas, and there's so much at once. So the fact that I had my toes in a number of different ponds, at least a little bit of part of a toe and a number of different ponds, it helped make some areas of the law just a little bit more familiar. So I was at Kirkland for a number of years. I then, in 2010, went to the SEC. I was a trial attorney in here in Chicago in the trial unit. I basically did a lot of offering frauds, insider trading. It is a real privilege to represent the government, especially the federal government. And I really relish the opportunity to do the right thing and for the right reasons and try to advance the people's interests as best as I possibly could. It also, I think, spoke to a need for me to feel like I was contributing something to society writ large and trying to make things better and contribute my talents in a positive way to my community. So I greatly enjoyed my time at the SEC, and frankly, if this opportunity at the Northern District hadn't come along, I wouldn't be surprised if I wouldn't have stayed there forever. But in the early part of the Trump administration, I knew that there were a number of vacancies. I think there were, three, four, five vacancies here at the Northern District. And, these opportunities don't come along all that often. And at the end of the day, we need good people in government. So I wound up interviewing at the White House in February of 2018. I was ultimately confirmed in September of 2019. So the process took about 18 months for me. Illinois, I think, functions a little bit differently than a number of states. We have a smooth process that has bipartisan weigh-in. Senator Durbin, to his eternal credit, should get a lot of credit for having a smooth running process in the state of Illinois that vets people cooperatively and gets people out there that hopefully everybody can agree on. So my process was long and my process was draining, but I think overall my process was smooth. I had the support of the administration, had the support of our Democratic senators. Senator Durbin was terrific. Senator Duckworth was terrific. I appreciated the bipartisan buy-in that they contributed. So after waiting a year and a half, I got confirmed in September of 2019. Been on the bench. I was on the bench for about 6 months when the pandemic struck, and since then, trying to make do as best I can. I would say since I took the bench, it's every day has felt like I'm on trial. You know, the feeling you get when you're on trial, the excitement, the energy, the pulse, the, you know, the quasi-overwhelming feeling, that the feeling that you've just got so much to do and so little to do it. That's what every day feels like a little bit. But I just couldn't be happier to be where I am. I am hitting the ball as hard as I can, and I am genuinely trying to apply the law as faithfully as I possibly can. So about a year and a half later, almost, here I am, and just happy to be here.
Thanks, everyone. I'm going to start some questions, and certainly to the extent you all want to ask each other things, please do so as well. But I'll start off by just asking what your biggest surprise has been since you've joined the federal bench. And we'll go back to Judge Seeger and go in the opposite order this time.
I think the biggest surprise for me has been the volume of the caseload. I was not sure what to expect going in. And I don't, you know, for those of you who are watching, think how many cases each of us probably has. Just guess a number and how many pending motions you think I have. I'll give you a second to figure it out. So inherited 342 civil cases. That's down now to about 315. I have hundreds of pending motions, and I can assure you that is not because I'm sitting around and letting these pending motions accumulate. That's just the load. I'm able to keep pace and handle them as they come in and go out, but it's very challenging as a district court judge to make progress and chip away at the mountain of cases that you've got. You know, last month, for example, I had 16 cases leave my docket. So that sounds like, you know, it's progress, but I had 28 new cases join my docket. So I was down 12 for the month. You know, every day, a little after midnight, I get an email that shows the number of filings that I had in my cases. And it's really something as a district court judge on this side of the veil to see the enormous payload that gets delivered every day, where the truck just backs up and you get the motions. I think it really underscores the need for brevity and the need to get to the point. There are other things that I could say about things that have surprised me, but that's what that'll be my answer. The volume of the workload.
Judge Radofsky.
So I have two. The first is exactly what Judge Seeger said, which is the volume. And I guess what I will focus on is I had some difficulty, and I'm still having some difficulty in having to figure out how to do it, finding the right balance between writing a polished, well-reasoned opinion that everybody will essentially either agree with or say, well, I don't agree with it, but it makes sense. And that will be very easy for the Eighth Circuit to then review if the case goes up. That's on the one hand. On the other hand is keeping the trains running on time and making decisions. And I think it's very difficult to balance those two needs. As of late, I have started trying to write much shorter opinions that really, as just Seeger said, just get to the point. I may be erring too much on the other side now, we'll see, but that has been a surprising sort of thing that I might have intellectually thought about it, but I didn't really emotionally think about how to do it. Number two, I would say, is I have been very surprised how little parties have taken appeals to the Eighth Circuit. And again, as Judge Seeger says, that's not because I haven't been doing anything. I've been issuing orders left and right, and a lot of them final orders. And I also don't think it has anything to do with, you know, whether or not people think my opinions are good or anything like that. I think more has to do with what an appeal takes and what an appeal costs and everything like that. And that just sort of reinforces the importance in my mind of getting it right for the parties, because while the Eighth Circuit is there as a backstop, I have learned that in 95% of cases, that is not a realistic backstop for people. And I'm really the first and last line for them.
Thanks, Judge Vischer.
You know, I think the thing that was most surprising to me, everyone fought really hard on my nomination and that resolved itself in the end, but really was the amount of authority that I have. And the types of cases that I was able to rule on, I've had several that are really, I guess, very large cases that have impact beyond me for many years that I've had to rule on in my first year. And, you know, it kind of actually illustrated to me why people do fight so hard for these positions, even on the district court, because, you know, they're just huge weighty matters that, if I go one way or the other, really have an impact in the state or in a small part of the world for a long time. And that's probably the most surprising thing to me. I thought I would have important things to do because I practiced in federal court my whole career. I knew that. But it is just the weight of them and the important matters that have just come in front of me, seems like not routinely, but semi-routinely, is the thing that's most surprising to me. And, you know, just to say a word about the volume as well, the volume is substantial here. And I have, you know, what I call the 90% rule. You know, in private practice, you want to get close to 100% on how good your writing is and how perfect it is and how it looks and how it presents itself. And getting that last 10% to almost perfect is a lot of work. Well, here we can't do that. If you try to do that, you will be so far behind. You will not get your docket cleaned off. But I call it this 90% rule. You get it 90% there, make sure everyone understands what you're saying and make sure it's right, and you got to let it go. Because if you don't, you'll be buried. And so there's my approach so far. We'll see how many times I get reversed before I decide to be 95%. So
that's really been surprising, hasn't it, with the opinion writing? I mean, when I was in private practice, I worked on a brief, and I felt like I had time to get it as good as I wanted it to get. And I feel now like I'm playing Frogger, you know, like I'm hopping around trying to go here to there, making the best moves I possibly can. But if you stay in any spot too long, you're going to get hit by a bus or eaten by a crocodile. You know, you just got to make the best move you can. I have an analogy. I think court of appeals judges versus district court judges, you know, court of appeals judges are playing chess and district court judges are playing speed chess. You know, there's not a lot of time in the clock. We've got this overwhelming pressure just to make the best move you can in the time you got and then move on.
Let me ask all of you, now that you're having to judge cases in areas of law that you've never practiced in, how do you get your mind around that area of the law enough to be wise? Judge Radosky.
So when you ask that question, my mind immediately goes to things like criminal law and sentencing and habeas, because that is what I had the least experience in coming to the bench. I mean, obviously there are civil things that, the law is very wide. So there's civil things too that come up that I don't know, but the criminal world is a little more difficult for me. And, I am very glad that I've had a lot of experience in this year and been able to sort of catch up. But the way I do it is what I imagine most people do when they're in a law firm job, right? You get a new case, you get a new thing, and you spend a whole lot of time looking at that area. And then you go and talk to people about it. Now, if you're in a law firm, you talk to your partners, you talk to your peers. The thing I get to do that makes it really nice for me is I get to talk to the lawyers that come in front of me. So I tend to have some oral hearings. I may even have some oral hearings on things that I know what I'm going to do with them. But part of what I do is I make sure that I get each attorney's view. And at least in the criminal world, I was surprised how many times you will get the United States Attorney and the Federal Defender's Office to agree on things. And truly, they educate me. We have a great, great U.S. Attorney's Department here. We have a really great Federal Defender's Office. And when they all agree on something, I can generally take it to the bank, and it helps me learn an area that I'm not particularly familiar with. So the short answer is I use our very, very competent attorneys to help me learn an area.
Good, Steger?
Yeah, I think it's been really quite an experience to feel firsthand the breadth of the law. I mean, I think all of us knew going into it that there were a lot of parts of law we didn't know a whole lot about, but it really comes to home when you take the bench and day after day you're hit with statutes that you'd never heard of before, or rules that you've never read before, or areas of the law that are foreign to you. It feels a little bit like parachuting into a tropical rainforest, and you're surrounded by all these exotic species. And, you hope every now and again you bump across something that you've seen before, or at least you recognize the plant's cousin, a little bit about it. I have tried to take comfort in the fact that it's really the job of the attorneys to educate you. And that's their role, to get the judge up to speed. It's something that I think lawyers probably don't fully appreciate, is it's their job to really lay the foundation for the judge and make sure that the judge has his or her bearings and knows enough about the law to render a decision. I have tried to be upfront with people. I don't like faking things. I like being straightforward with people. If I don't understand the law, or I don't get it, or I don't know, I just tell lawyers, you got to explain this to me, or I'll shoot out a list of questions for them. So these are the kinds of things I'm worried about or thinking about. But I think just as a general matter, as a district court judge, it's really, you're hit with a lot. So I think lawyers should be mindful that the judge at any given point in time has a ton on his or her plate, and you need to make sure that you have laid the foundation for the court appropriately.
Judge Fisher.
When it comes to new areas of the law, the thing I try to do for me is, and I try to impress upon the young lawyers that I work with here as my clerks, is you never believe that you know everything. It's the lawyers who think they know more than they really do are the ones who make mistakes. And, in our world today, we've got a lot of young lawyers who come in and really like, all right, I really know what I'm doing and all this stuff. There's a danger to that, because you have to understand what you don't know. And that comes to me too. So when I come in here and I'm starting to sentence defendants to federal prison, and I had done very little criminal work prior to this. I was a civil lawyer. I was civil, did mostly large federal cases, quite frankly, is what I did. I, really had to go back to school and understand and make sure, and I still do this, I make sure I have law clerks look into all the legal issues and make sure I look at it and understand it at least the best I can before I make the decision. And I think just quite honestly, the way you prepare for the areas of law you don't know as well is you go back to school yourself. You prepare for it as if you know you don't know it. And even if I think I know it, I always second guess myself again just to make sure I didn't miss something. And that's what I try to do. And the other thing too we have here at the federal courts is we've got law clerks, and you're able to hire very smart people. And that's so helpful to the cause, because we have so much work to do. The fact that you can have someone research it and get back to you and give you the information you need to make the right decisions is extremely helpful. So that's what I'd say on that.
Let me add one other thing, which I just thought of. Something I've started recently is I have about a 45-minute drive home, maybe an hour, depending on how traffic is. And one of the things I've been doing is listening to Supreme Court oral arguments on my ride home. And essentially every case, right? The interesting ones and the ones that are not so interesting. And my theory is that it will at least give me a little bit of insight into all of these different areas of law Not that I'm going to remember it or remember what was discussed or anything else, but once if there's an issue that's relevant or related to something I heard, at least I might have something to go on and recall that, you know, oh, I heard they were talking about this, and this is an important thing to think about here. And then I can have law clerks or anybody else sort of go off and get the details of it.
So in our last 20 minutes, we have a number of questions from the participants here today. I'm going to just read them and throw them out there, and whoever has something to chime in on, please feel free to do so. The first one's from Jeffrey Ventrella, and Jeff writes, "Your Honors, what is your process and your sources for identifying law clerks suitable to your chambers?"
Well, so far, what I've done is when you first get on the bench, you're kind of scrambling to find law clerks, to be honest with you, okay? You need someone who's immediately available because you're immediately going to be very busy. And I was fortunate to grab one individual who was supposed to be starting at the Attorney General's office on a Monday, and I hired him on Sunday, and he showed up to work for me instead. So luckily, the Attorney General was nice enough to let me have that individual. And then, of course, I found some other individuals who were very good. And so I got lucky in that respect. But when it comes to now, what I do is I do participate in the process that the administrative office of the court sponsors, which is you apply online with the AO's process, and then they release the resumes to me in June. So some people like to hire people before that process. I have so far participated in that process, and I think I will again this year. I plan to. So I will get all the, and it's kind of a scramble. You got basically, you know, all the good candidates are kind of talked to at the same time, but I like doing that. I got 110 or 120 applications last time they went through. And so that's what I do.
Anyone else?
I use Oscar too. I think it's an overwhelming volume of applications. I mean, being in an urban area with a lot of law schools locally, it attracts a lot of applicants. I think last count I had almost 1,000 applications. I've been able to find people in large part by word of mouth, and then, you know, a professor will call me and say, look, you really ought to look at this person. That's basically what I do.
So when I got on the bench, I hired for my first set of clerks for about a year and a half. And then I hired my second set of clerks, some for 2 years after that and some for 1 year after that. And now I'm sort of at the point where going forward after that, I'm going to start the kind of Oscar process. I really wanted to have my clerks set for about 3 or 4 years so I wouldn't feel sort of pressure to get people. And also, quite frankly, because I'm not really sure up until that point, I know very much what I want. So the first set and second set of clerks I got by word of mouth. After that, I feel like I am going to use and rely on Oscar. But as Judge Seeger said, and maybe I'll put a little bit of a different emphasis on it than he did, word of mouth is really important, right? There are lawyers who I know and trust and think that their counsel makes sense and think that they have good judgment. And so if they tell me that somebody is really fantastic, I will definitely spend my time looking at them. I will say for my chambers, it's a relatively involved process. And I just copied, when I was clerking, I copied Judge Kleinfeld's process. I'm not sure if I'm going to revise it because it may not make sense in, as Judge Boucher talked about, sort of a mad rush that happens in June. But essentially, an applicant walks through an interview with each of my three clerks. And if they make it through that, I will then have a Zoom interview with them. That may not be sustainable over the long run, and we may have to do it quicker than that. But that's what I'm doing now. Word of mouth matters a whole lot to me.
So the next question,
go ahead.
A couple of questions related, so I'll lump them together from Scout Snowden and David Sterling. And it's basically, now that you're on the bench, what would you have done differently while you were in private practice, knowing what you know now in terms of writing briefs, making arguments, et cetera? Anyone who has thoughts on that?
You know, what I would do differently is I think brevity is more valuable. You know, when you write a brief and you're getting paid to do it, and it's an important case and it's worth a lot of money, you're like, all right, got to hit it all. Okay. But I will tell you, though, most effective briefs are the ones that get to the point, get it out, cite the best law, and get out of the way. And I think that is way more effective in front of a court, at least from my perspective.
Have you ever read a brief where you say to yourself, boy, I wish this thing was longer? It hasn't happened to me yet. You know, I've been surprised by the briefs that don't tell you what the punchline is. Like I'll be halfway into it before I know what they're arguing because they haven't told me. Brevity, I think, is the key thing. And I think the first couple of pages are the most crucial part of any brief. Not because the judge is only going to read that, but because you've got to frame the reader's perspective from the very first moment. That's the best real estate in the brief. The reader is there. The reader is paying attention. I don't think attorneys give enough thought to how they start their briefs. A lot of briefs start with, I, so-and-so, represented by lawyer from such-and-such law firm, hereby say on behalf of so-and-so that this is my response to, and it's just totally wasted real estate. I can read the caption. I know what you're saying. I know it's a response to a motion to whatever. And I can see from ECF what it is. Don't tell me that. I already know that. But you just totally wasted the first paragraph. Have something catchy. Give me the main point. You know, propose a principle or give me a fact that really should turn things in your favor. I think intros really don't get the attention they deserve.
I think all of that is right. I will hit three other points really quickly, or at least I'll try to be quick. The first one is, I think lawyers sometimes put the legal analysis, or put more of an emphasis on the legal analysis than the facts. And I think especially for district court judges, explaining and untangling the facts, again, whether if it's a motion to dismiss, explaining the complaint, if it's summary judgment, explaining the facts, but getting really into the factual analysis, I think helps, because often that's the most confusing part of the case for us if we're just spending, you know, 3 hours with it as opposed to a much longer time. I think number two, and this may go hand in hand with that, is lawyers tend to sort of want to make analogies or metaphors or jump to the conclusion in some sense, as opposed to just sort of painstakingly write it out there and put it in front of you. And the problem is that assumes that the judge is as understanding of your case as you are, and that's just not true, right? So the more you can sort of just put it in red and blue blinkers for us, the better that is, and not sort of, you know, do the well I'm smart and you're smart, so you must be able to make this logical conclusion. It's much easier to have the logical conclusion written in front of us. And then the third thing, and I get, you know, look, this is a Federalist Society panel, so maybe it's useful to say this. I think one of the big impediments to district court judges doing a good job with textualism and originalism is not the lack of effort. I think it's the lack of time. It takes a whole lot of time to really go back, especially if you're dealing with a statute from 1847, to figure out where the right Black's Law Dictionary is, to figure out what the statutory, not legislative history, but what the statutory history was back then, to figure out what was going on in society at that time in a real way, not in a sort of armchair historian way. And I guess for me, I would love to see more either textualist or originalist briefs that really do that in a quick, clear way. I don't have the time necessarily to do as much of that as I would like. And I think that leads to an incentive for district court judges who especially want to do a textualist and originalist analysis to not be able to go there 100% of the way.
Very good point. Just to follow up on that, Judge Rudowski, what could litigants do to help you
So for me, and this may, this, you know, look, in the world of it's an art, not a science, this is a little bit in tension with everything else I've been saying, but I actually would love, in some of my more difficult cases, I would love a very short amicus brief from somebody who was concentrated on textualism and originalism, right? So there are lots of amicus briefs that do that up at the circuit courts and certainly at the Supreme Court, but people tend not to do that down at the district court. It's somewhat ironic because I actually think it might even make a bigger practical difference for a district court judge to get something like that, which would be enormously helpful.
And I would just add, and this group probably isn't the group I need to say this to, but I think it's interesting that, you know, some litigants, they have to understand who they're arguing to. And if you give me 4 pages on legislative history, you're not utilizing your space in your brief very well, all right? Because if you do any research, you can probably find out that what a senator said during a debate isn't all that, you know, interesting most of the time, to me at least. Because a senator can say anything. The question is, what does the statute say and what does the language say and what does that language mean? That's where the rubber hits the road for me most of the time. And I think lawyers really, some of them don't think about who they're arguing to, and they want to argue to the judge to get to, if they want to win their point, they got to think about that when they're making their argument as to what this judge might consider most important to making the decision.
The briefs in general, I agree with all of that by both of you. The briefs in general do not focus on the text enough or at an adequate depth.
We received a very interesting question from Jeff Hamby. What's your biggest fear about being a federal judge?
Oh, that's easy for me, that I give somebody the wrong sentence. That there's no question in my mind that the hardest thing I do is come up with an appropriate sentence, or I should say try to come up with an appropriate sentence for somebody who has committed a crime, balancing all the various factors that the statute tells me to balance. That is such a serious thing, right? You're taking away somebody's liberty. And on the flip side, you're trying to make sure that you protect society adequately, as well as a number of other things. But that's a really, really hard call. And anybody, I think, who says they know the answer and that they're right on a particular sentence is either pretending or is just sort of out to lunch. We come up with what we think is the best, but with a, I think, real understanding that we may be too high or too low on any given case.
I think that's right. Let me just echo that. I think for me, it's getting it wrong in a criminal case. I mean, the law can seem very abstract sometimes, but in a criminal case, it gets very real. It gets very personal. You deal with a person, a human being, that's standing in front of you. And I think that creates enormous pressure to get it right when you're talking about somebody's liberty.
And I just have to agree with that. That's the hardest part of this gig.
We received a question from one of our Arkansas State Representatives, Doug House. Thank you, Representative House, for being here today. He asks about your workload. He comments that from what you've said, it sounds like we need more district court judges. He says, recognizing the need to stay in your lane, do we need to lobby for more judges at the federal level?
Okay, I'll take it. Representative House is a great guy, and I think I can call him, and I'm happy to call him a friend. I'm not going to touch that one. I don't know if anybody else is going to touch that one. I think the judiciary as a whole has said that there should be some more judgeships in various places around the country. But in terms of sort of specific places and where they should be and where they shouldn't, to me, it's just a little bit too political.
I think that's exactly right. Whenever you get a question that starts, should we lobby for? The answer to that is, I'm not touching that. The only thing I'll say is, you know, judicial resources are finite. You know, I can hit the ball as hard as I can every day, but there's only so much I can do. And it's going to have to depend on people who are wiser and smarter than a guy like me to figure out what the right number is. But, you know, judicial resources are, I think, being tested right now.
I'll go ahead. Yes.
I'm sorry, Judge.
I'll go ahead and punt. So go ahead.
Okay. Well, we have 5 minutes left, and I want to be respectful of everyone's time today. So I just wanted to turn it back over to each of you to see if you have any closing thoughts or remarks that you'd like to pass along to the group. Judge Radofsky?
I think we've covered a lot of ground. I don't know that I have any particular closing remarks. Other than to say again that it is a, and I think Steve said this before, Judge Seeger, it is an incredible honor to be on the bench. And, you know, everyone sort of says that flippantly, it's an honor to do this, it's an honor to do that. After you've done this job for a while, it really is an honor to do this, because what is very clear is not that I'm better or worse at this than anybody else, but that somebody needs to do this job for society, and through either some combination of skill, luck, and happenstance, the president decided it should be me, and the Senate confirmed me. And I'm really just trying to do my best for, I think, all of us. And my sense is that's really what every judge is trying to do, regardless of whatever jersey they might have had on or not had on before they came to the bench. And regardless of any judicial philosophy they have, this is a very, very humbling job. And it hits you quite quickly how both important and, in some sense, awesome, I guess in the real sense of the word, how awesome it is. And I think that leads to people trying to do their best.
Judge Bisher?
You know, on the federal bench, it is very interesting to me just meeting the judges out there. And I probably know a lot of the newly installed judges, the newly confirmed judges more because they send us to training and all of this stuff. But what's amazing to me is how many really smart people who are really capable and have a lot of options in life that end up in this position. And like Judge Radofsky said, well, I'm not special. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time and decided to do it, right? And decided to say yes when they asked me. And the fact that we have such a quality judiciary and the brains that are here doing this job is really amazing. I mean, it really is. And I come out of this and I go through this with the sincere understanding and belief that we have we're very well served nationally by the federal judiciary, because we have people who really care about being right more than advancing their cause. And in fact, advancing their cause doesn't even cross their mind, no matter who, what aisle, what part of the aisle you're on. It doesn't matter. You know, our job is to be right. That is our position. We're no matter how we got here. And luckily we have a lot of very brilliant people willing to step up to the plate to do it. So, you know, that's what I have to say after, you know, sitting in this chair for a little over a year now.
We'll conclude with Judge Seeger.
I would echo again what Judge Radofsky and Judge Bisher said. This job has really given me a newfound appreciation for the judiciary. You have so many people who are working so hard just to get it right and get to the right answer. And I've really gotten I've really been struck repeatedly how our judicial system in general tries to get to the right answer, tries to treat people fairly, and tries to get it right. And part of that is just the system of governance that we've constructed. And some of it is the caliber of the people appointed by presidents of both parties who just want to follow the law and just want to get it right. And, you know, that's what I'm trying to do. That's what Judge Radofsky and Judge Bisher are trying to do. So I've really gotten an appreciation for the system and for the people. And rest assured that, you know, in a case the judge may or may not rule in your favor, that's how it goes. But I can say with a high degree of confidence that the judges on your cases are trying really hard to get to the right answer and doing the right thing, meaning following the law as faithfully as they possibly can.
Judges, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. And for everyone who's attended today, thank you so much. And for our friends from Nebraska and Chicago, I'm glad that you were able to join us today. One of the great things, maybe one of the few great things about the world we're living in right now is nobody thinks anything is odd about having a large Zoom meeting, but it allows us to bring people from different places across the country together like this. And for that, I can be appreciative. And on behalf of everyone, I'd like to wish you all a happy holiday season and a prosperous 2021. Thank you again for your time.
Thanks, everyone. Take care now.